It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your hosts, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell & Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 252-247-7282, and let's talk legal.
Well, let's do that. We got both gentlemen in the studio this morning. Good morning, Cecil. Good morning, Wes.
Good morning, Mike.
Seems like just yesterday we were here talking about HOAs and homeowners associations and all that. But I have to remind you, gentlemen, it's not Monday. It's Tuesday. You guys had off. But
Well, it is. And, you know, some of these Monday holidays make it a little bit easy. It makes it an optimum opportunity to forget that we're supposed to be here on Tuesday mornings. But Wes and I are both here this morning.
You answered the call.
So that's good.
You answered the call.
I think, Mike, we might talk about and kind of decipher a little bit, demystify the word trust. I think a lot of us are a bit confused about what that exactly means. And let's just start with a definition, okay, which is a trust is basically a contract between three people, three parties, and the parties are the creator of the trust, the person who wants to create a trust, and then the beneficiary of the trust, the person who's going to benefit from the property that's in the trust. And then lastly, the fiduciary or the trustee who is going to oversee this property for the benefit of the beneficiary. So there are three parties, and it's a contractual agreement whereby the creator of the trust says that I want you to have the following property, and I want you to hold it for the benefit of the beneficiary. Now, the next thing to talk about is, you know, that, Mike, there are just an untold number of objectives to have a trust, reasons to have a trust. And Wes and I always begin with, you know, ironically, with the reverse, which is that, do you really need a trust? If you don't, if our client doesn't need a trust, if there isn't a strong objective, I, for instance, have a client, my first client this morning, that the question was whether or not it was necessary to have a trust, and it was not. So if you don't need a trust, if there's not a strong objective, reason, rationale, then let's don't have a trust, okay? Let's don't create that contract. It just isn't necessary. We'll go ahead and have the assets pass according to a last will and testament. But let's go through some of the reasons or rationales, and then Wes is going to chime in here in a minute. I mean, clearly, you know, minor children.
Okay.
A handicapped adult child. You know, a child that has had some medical and or physical or emotional issues. We have many, many files like this. And there are many listeners out there that a little bell went off. Yep, that's me. I have an adult child that lives at home and always has. And these clients have a real emotional situation. I'm always so sympathetic to them because they're taking control and nurturing their child and providing for their 35-year-old son. But what in the world happens when I'm no longer here? Okay. So many times they will need a trust. Okay.
Is there a modifier to that type of trust when you're taking, when a parent is taking care of an adult child? Is there a word in front of that trust? The word trust, is there a modifier to that, or you just say it's a trust?
Special needs.
Special needs trust?
It's SNT, special needs trust, supplemental needs trust. Okay. And the kind of overriding idea with regard to that type of trust is, okay, when I die, mom and dad, when mom and dad dies, who's going to take care of the special needs child?
Okay.
We have life insurance for him. We have some assets for him. But he also gets benefits now, supplemental security income, okay? What happens when we pass away and we leave these assets to this child? Well, we know his SSI stops because that's based on what assets he owns. So we leave those assets into that trust for that child.
Okay.
We direct the life insurance by the beneficiary designation not to the child directly, but to the trust, so that there are assets there to take care of the needs of this special needs child, but we still don't lose our benefits that we've qualified for under, in many cases, SSI. So
good.
Okay. Yeah. So let's keep going here with some strong reasons to have a trust. Minor child, special needs child, clients who just simply have high net worth, and they're going to divide their net worth between their two children, but their children are, you know, 21, and they just don't think they should have the entire net worth at 21, their majority age. But I'd like for my sister or brother to hold on things and distribute it more at, like, say, age 25, 30, and 35.
Okay.
Let's let them have a third, a third, and a third, okay? All right. Clearly, there are trusts to protect assets. We've talked about this so much on the program from time to time about a trust, that the purpose of which is to protect the assets from the devastation of a long-term expense at a nursing home.
Mm-hmm.
There are trusts for tax purposes, estate tax purposes. Those trusts are less frequent by far than they used to be because, of course, the estate tax threshold is so very high now, you know, $20 million. And mm-hmm. so very few people trigger that kind of net worth. So estate tax trusts are not as frequent as they used to be, but they do still exist from time to time. So you're beginning to see that we listen to the client, and their objectives, and then potentially their objectives fit into the need that they then create a trust. Okay, one of these purposes that I just spoke of comes to the table, comes to the conversation.
Yeah.
Another trust that is a type of trust are trust for second marriages, where the spouse wishes, of course, to provide assets for the benefit of their surviving spouse, but upon the death of the surviving spouse, they want those assets to pass back to their children from their first marriage. So this might be referred to as a spousal trust, an elective share trust, a trust that basically provides for the benefit of a second or third spouse. Okay, that is again a very common factual scenario that we see. Now let's apply the definition to one of these. Let's do, for instance, the special needs child, mm-hmm. Michael. So the grantor or creator, the person who wants the trust, is the first party, and that would be, wouldn't it be, the mother, the father,
the parent,
or
sure.
the parent, or mm-hmm. both of them. Okay, the beneficiary is going to be the special needs child. And it doesn't mean that that's the only beneficiary. It might be that these good folks have two children.
Sure.
And their one child gets 50% outright, doesn't need to be in the trust. The other child is the special needs child, and so that 50% is within the context and control of the special needs trust. So the special needs child would be known as the beneficiary. And then the third party that we need is someone to oversee this money, or land, or asset, or life insurance, as Wes mentioned, whatever the asset happens to be. And that, of course, would be the trustee. And so maybe that would be the other child that is fine, healthy, and, you know, maybe it would be, you know, a member of the family, okay, an uncle, an aunt. Maybe it would even be a grown niece or nephew now that became a CPA or became a lawyer or you know, is doing well and would be a great trustee for the benefit of the handicapped child or the child with special needs. So we do have to find that person, that magical person, trustee, and we need to always remember, and this question comes up frequently, the trustee. These assets are not for the benefit of the trustee, and the trustee may better be very careful in drawing a clear line in the sand, Mike, as to the fact that these are assets that I hold for the benefit of the beneficiary. And other than a trustee's commission reimbursed for expenses, the trustee must use the assets for the benefit of the beneficiary, and there can be no self-dealing.
I'm wondering, too, in our previous conversations, we talked about a deep bench as far as witnesses to like a will or a durable power of attorney. Having the fiduciary, if you just select one person, should you have an alternate or several alternates behind that initial prime fiduciary?
Yeah, in 20 years of practicing in Cecil's practice, 50 years, 60, 80, I don't know. I think his birthday is this week. You probably don't want me to say that on the radio, but he's practiced longer than I have. Like, I can't think of any trust I've ever prepared where there was just one trustee and no successors. We're always asking that question.
Yeah.
You know, what happens if your first person, as you say, who's in the lineup, you know, the number one off the bench or first one up is, passes away or, you know, gets an accident, gets hurt, you know, whatever it may be and is not able to serve. So no doubt about that we really do that across the board. And, you know, all lawyers do that who practice in this area. You're going to be asking the questions about, you know, what if your number one can't act? Who's your number two? And sometimes we go to number three and even number four based on the circumstances. Mm-hmm. But I mean, at a minimum, we're looking at your primary trustee and then your secondary. And then we'll go to the third, the tertiary next. If there's a logical choice there, you know, for the client and they've got someone third in line. Sometimes they've got, let's say, you know, four kids and one of them is special needs. Well, I'm going to name kid number one as trustee and then kid number two and kid number three in that order because they want to put them all down. Yeah. They don't want to hurt the kids' feelings.
Sure.
So we end up with three and go three deep in that particular circumstance. But as you say, same thing as we're talking about an executor. We don't go just one deep with the executor. We'll go two or three depending on the circumstances. Power of attorney, healthcare power of attorney, all of these fiduciary roles. We want to sit down with the client when we're doing this work and act like this is the last time we're ever going to do this. Okay. We're not going to leave things out there. Oh, we'll do that later. No, we're going to get it perfect, you know, at this point in time. And, you know, obviously if we need to modify it at some point in time, that's fine. But let's get it right and get everything perfect. So, and that includes, you know, going, as you say, two, maybe three deep as it relates to your successors.
Let's take this call, gentlemen, before we go to a break. We got James and Betty calling. Good morning, James.
Morning, guys. I have a lien against a couple, and I've re-upped it once already. Is there a way that I can actually get them to pay the lien? Or is it just keep re-upping it and wait for them to die and then collect on what money is left over after the state takes what it's going to for the taxes? Because I know they owe taxes on the property they're living on right now.
So, James, what you're saying is you have a judgment that you received in court. Is that what you're saying?
Yep.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
All right. So, and when you say you re-upped it, are you saying that it got close to the end of its life being 10 years and you renewed it?
Yep.
All right. So you're in the second 10 year run on that.
Yep.
Okay. Well, good deal. So what you're talking about is execution, on the judgment or on the lien. And, you know, we do that quite often for clients. And basically the circumstance for that is the client will come in, we'll look at the judgment, we'll do some background work with regard to determining what the judgment creditor has and make a determination as to whether it is worth executing on the judgment. Now, that's the first thing you do, because in the event that their assets are limited or you're in a inferior or secondary position regarding other liens on the property, then it might not be worth to execute on the lien. Okay. So that's the first thing that we do. Second thing would be that let's say we make the determination, hey, there's some real property there. It looks like there's some equity in that property. It looks like the equity in that property is more than what our judgment amount is. So we can begin that process of executing on the lien. And it's a statutory process where we go through several different steps, giving the creditor notice about their right to claim certain exemptions, which we could advise you about, and then basically getting to the point where we get a court order that then allows us either to sell property or, if it's personal property, for to have the sheriff's office go and collect property to then sell and apply toward our lien. So there is a process for doing that. But before we do that, obviously, we've got to look at it, make sure it's in your best interest to do it, as opposed to what you said, maybe waiting and understanding that you are getting 8% interest on this lien, as you know, I'm sure. And then upon, you know, the death of the creditor, becoming, an actual creditor through the administration of the estate and collecting in that way. So there's a way to do it, but the answer with regard to whether it's, advisable or not is that, you know, it takes a little bit of homework, a little bit of digging to first make a determination, before we, you know, go down that path of the execution, on the lien. But you don't have to just wait. If you don't want to, is what I'm telling you.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So, kind of a long answer to a short question. I apologize.
Yeah, no, oh, it's fine. It's fine. We have looked at it from all angles. They own their property outright where they're living right now. And right now, from what my lawyer has told me, they have back taxes owed on that property already.
Gotcha.
And so I know the state is going to collect long before I get to collect, which is fine. I mean, I give the devil his due.
Right.
That belongs to them. And I know I'm second in line because I have a primary lien. And at that point, it's a waiting game because they've denied everything to the sheriff. So every time the sheriff shows up, they've denied it to the sheriff that this is yada, 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 whatever. And so we've gotten nothing. And all it's done is cost me money.
Okay.
And granted, that gets tacked on to the dollar amount because that's what my lawyer has done. He's tacked it on. Every time we serve papers and stuff like that, that costs me money out of my pocket.
Right.
And so he tacks that on to the next lien. And I just was wondering if there's any other way other than what I'm already doing, which is waiting.
It sounds like I described what your lawyer is already doing, so good for him. Sounds like he's doing the right thing and kind of doing that homework and making a determination as to whether there's anything to collect there, and identifying tax liens is one of the first things we would want to do because, you know, the tax man gets paid first. So you sound like that you've got someone, you know, your attorney who's sending you down the right path with regard to what he's doing. So, there is no magic tool in the toolbox other than what I've described and what your lawyer's doing. So,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
I really appreciate the call.
I just wanted to make sure that it was going along fine, this waiting game, so going from there.
Yes, sir. Thank you for the call.
Thanks, James. Patience. We're going to take a short break here. If you'd like to reach Harvell and Collins after the show, James, you may want to make a second call, 252-726-9050, or check them out online, harvellandcollins.com. We'll be right back. We're talking about trusts. It's a matter of trust after we get that through this break. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Let's Talk Legal. We're talking about trusts, and we're talking with Cecil and Wes.
You know, that was a great call, and thank that caller for calling in. James, a little bit of a good news real quick is that about 2 weeks ago we had a judgment. I was a little bit involved in it. It was a friend who was telling me about it, kind of similar to James, and he called me and said, Cecil, you won't believe it. I got a big check today from the clerk of court. That judgment I've had for 2 years finally got paid. So, you know, something happened and it had to be paid.
Mm-hmm.
So the people are trapped. I'm sure James knows that. He's been advised about that in terms of being able to sell their house, mortgage their house, equity line their house. None of those things can happen as long as those liens are there until they're first satisfied. Back to trust for a minute.
Let me mention one comment about that since
Absolutely.
We're on trust. So, you know, one of the things that happens when we're talking about these trusts is that like a a parent dies of the creditor and they inherit something, and then all of a sudden, here we are in a situation where this judgment, okay, is against the inheritance, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, boom, we get a check. And that's a great call when we get those checks. I call my client, you know, hey, I've got a big check for you. Hey, remember that judgment we got, you know, 8 years ago? That kind of thing. But think about this. Let's say that the judgment creditor knew about this judgment and used a trust, you know, through their parents, through the inheritance to protect the asset.
Yeah.
And that asset was left into an irrevocable trust. Then the judgment creditor still wouldn't be able to get to it. So that kind of goes into that asset protection. A lot of times when you're dealing with trust issues, it's anticipating something that may happen if you don't have the trust.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden when it happens, you're dead in the water. You can't do anything about it because you didn't plan ahead. That's a like 80, 90% of the use of a trust. You got to kind of use it on the front end.
Absolutely. We have absolutely had clients, Mike, who have come to us to seek advice about the fact that they are a bit concerned about some sort of contingent liability or the possibility of a liability over some sort of circumstance. Maybe they were involved in some sort of development of a product
or
whatever the case might be. Mm-hmm. And so they are seeking a trust to take their property out of their individual name where the judgment might attach and into a trust which would in effect keep the judgment creditor for being able to attach their individual property, that is, if the trust is prepared properly.
And we've had that conversation in using the widow as an example, I believe, in the nursing home and putting it into the trust. You still
have
the property.
Right, that's another element of a very specific type of asset protection.
We'll continue this conversation after this break, and maybe it's something we're going to be talking about in the weeks to come because I think we've just scratched the surface about trust. We'll be right back after this brief message with Harbell and Collins. Welcome back to Let's Talk Legal, and we'll continue the conversation and close today about talking about trust.
And Mike, we can continue this topic next week because in addition to the definition, which is a contract, and in addition to the parties, which are the three parties that we've discussed, the next thing, of course, is to discuss, you know, and to bring to light for all of our listeners is the terms and provisions. We talked about contingent trustees, there being BACA, but when does the trust end? What happens if the beneficiary dies? We've got to discuss now, what does the contract say? How long does it last? What if the beneficiary dies? We've kind of focused today a little bit on our special needs child. Well, suppose that, you know, at, you know, 50 or 60 years old, you know, this special needs child, you know, it's their time and they're no longer with us. Well, there were assets in the trust, weren't there?
Sure.
You know, they were being governed by the trustee for the benefit of the special needs child. Now what happens to those assets? The trust is going to have to say, it's going to have to address upon the death of the special needs child, any assets, income, and principal still located in the trust are to be distributed as follows. So we have contingent beneficiaries. A trust, unlike a last will and testament, has really got to talk about some contingencies because the trust could potentially, an estate opens up and within a year it closes. And it's done. A trust can last for the lifetime of a child, for the lifetime of a particular beneficiary. Many, many years, 10, 20, 25, 30, 35 years. And so we've got to talk about what happens with those assets during the time of the administration of the trust.
It's ever changing. It's not the same.
Correct.
When you create it. Mm-hmm. Let's continue this conversation next Tuesday with Let's Talk Legal. This is a very good topic. If you want to reach Harvell and Collins after the show, call them 252-726-9050 or go online to harvellandcollins.com. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks, Mike.
Happy birthday, Cecil.